Welcome to the Smart Dating Academy podcast. I'm Bella Gandhi, the founder of Smart Dating Academy and your host. I started Smart Dating Academy in 2009 because I had this crazy knack of giving people dating advice that actually worked, that I took. I've been married for almost 25 years, and now my company helps people to date smarter and to find love. This podcast is meant to bring more love into your life, no matter where you are and what you do. And we're here to bring more life into your love. Smart daters, welcome back to the podcast. I am, as you know, excited, beyond excited, psychotically optimistic, and in rare form today because the guest I have today is like the guest of all guests. Okay. So excited to present to you my friend, Amy Ferris. Amy, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome. And thank you for having me. This is like a treat beyond. Oh my God. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I feel like I'm with the queen goddess.
Oh my God. Absolutely not. You are the queen goddess.
We could punch this out after. We can do a punch out after, but you are the queen goddess.
I'll meet you by the bike racks. How does that sound?
You got it. I got the Schwinn. Go ahead.
Oh my gosh. Well, let me tell you about the mighty, gorgeous Amy Ferris. She is an author, editor, screenwriter, and playwright. Her memoir, wait for it, you guys, Marrying George Clooney, Confessions from a Midlife Crisis, was adapted into an off-Broadway play in 2012. How badass is that? As a screenwriter, she co-wrote the film Mr. Wonderful and was nominated for a Best Screenplay Award for her adaptation of the film Funny Valentines. You guys, this woman is so awesome. There's like 1,000 other sentences in her bio, but she also recently co-authored the book Old School Love with Rev Run of Run DMC fame. I'm a Gen Xer, you guys. So Run DMC, OMG. In 2019, she was named one of Women's E! News' 21 leaders for the 21st century. I mean, she's a friend of my friend, Jill Scherer Murphy, and she's here because she's friggin' awesome. And she's been the author of the new book, which you'll be able to order, called Mighty Gorgeous, A Little Book About Messy Love. Amy, holy smokes. You're amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to take that compliment. After hearing what I have done in my life, I'm going to take that compliment. Yes.
You're like, who's that badass? Wow. Hey. Oh, wow.
Who is that badass?
That is me. Tell us a little book about messy love. Let's start there. What inspired you to write this? Tell us a little bit about messy love.
Ooh, I think messy love is everything. I think it's marriage. I think it's dating. I think it's breaking up. I think it's tossing crap in the corner. I think it's friendship. I think it's everything. I think everything is about a relationship. Everything. Everything is relation, is the foundation of, you know, relationships, right? Messy love is about my marriage to Ken. Messy love is about finding myself. Messy love is about dropping out of high school and, you know, kind of rebelling. Messy love is about my own, finding my own heart.
Oh my God. Amazing. And you guys, I was so lucky to get an advanced reader copy of this amazing book. And I literally sent Amy a note this morning when I finished it, like, oh my God, I have so many thoughts. I have so many feelings. I need to go for a really long run to process this. I'm in love with you. I'm in love with this book. And I just, you guys, I've never done this, but I'm so compelled by the intro. I think I want to begin by taking a couple of minutes. I want you to hear Amy's voice in my voice. And I'm going to read you the intro, okay, about to messy love. In 67 years, I've had my heart ripped to shreds, broken into pieces, and crazy glued back together. I dropped out of high school, tried suicide, and spent some time on a commune. I was thrown out for shaving my legs. True story. I got my GED at 17 and never went on to college. I filled my body with enough drugs to open a pharmacy, and I slept with the gazillion wrong men whose first name was either Joe or David or I'll call ya. I fell down, I got up. I fell down, I got up. I fell down, I got up. I spent all the money I made as a waitress and temp worker on fast food and useless dreck. And then I started making a ton of dough as a writer. I wrote a couple of groovy movies that got made into groovy films and have had more than a few books published. I have loved bad men and cruel men and married the coolest guy on the fucking planet. I've been betrayed and hurt and cracked wide open by women friends, and you'll still get me to love you and champion you and toss you a line. I lost my mom to dementia, and I lost my dad to a heart attack, and my family unraveled into a million estranged threads. I don't believe in God, but I do believe we are all capable of being God or goddess-like, kind, good, loving, and compassionate. And I do believe if there is a God, it is a woman. I think Colin Kaepernick is a superhero, and men who abuse their power are insecure and small, little, fucked up, slimy creeps. I believe in second chances, and I believe that the third time is in fact a charm. I believe there's nothing more glorious than a human who can stand in their own power and be comfortable in their own skin and own their beauty and their greatness. I can safely say that, yes, I have made it to that place. I believe getting loved is way better than getting laid. But getting laid beats phone sex by a good mile. But nothing beats self-love, nothing. I know for a fact that kind is way better than nice, and that the Verizon friends and family plan is pretty bogus. I recommend we put a fast halt on being needed and pump the motherfucker gas on being wanted. Oof, take that one. I feel strongly about inequality and injustice, and that poverty destroys and kills more lives than we care to admit. I know for a fact that depression comes in waves and tsunamis, and dementia grabs you by the throat and doesn't let you go. I know that money doesn't buy you happiness or friendship or love, but having some cash sure the fuck makes you less worried. I learned a long time ago that marrying well can't hold a candle to marrying good. And if you can't find a light at the end of the tunnel, you are in the wrong fucking tunnel. There is always a light somewhere. I love that my life is made up of broken, edgy, frayed, magnificent, glorious, sexy, gooey, messy, amazing life pieces. I am so proud of who I have become, because I got to say, for a while, it was touch and fucking go. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. I mean, you guys, this is just the intro. Amy, just, I'm going to turn the mic over to you. Talk to us. Tell us about your growing up.
Oh my God. First of all, can I just say, hearing you read that made me so proud of me. I don't know if I can actually even talk right now. I've never heard anybody read it out loud.
It's amazing.
So I just have to thank you for giving me the opportunity to hear about me and how proud I am of me. It really, I genuinely, wholeheartedly mean this. It's astonishing to hear somebody read your life with such passion and authenticity and authority. And I think, and I'm pretty sure that what you just did is you just kind of cracked open my heart from my own life. So thank you. And I mean that. Thank you.
You're welcome. I had lots of people with lots of books on this show, and that intro just gripped me because it's fierce, it's real, it's authentic. And I love that you wrote this book as a lesson to your younger self and lessons to all of us. And that's why I just couldn't be more honored and happy to have you here to talk to us about the fact that you didn't just get placed up on this pedestal. You had a long, winding, messy road to get to where you are now. And in retrospect, you can tell all of us, you can tell little Amy and little Bella and all of us out there, you know what? I believe in you and you're beautiful just the way you are. So tell us a little bit about your growing up. I mean, that's pretty awesome.
You know, I grew up out on Long Island, you know, in the suburbs, and there was always a feeling of I didn't belong. Mm. And it wasn't that I didn't feel like I didn't belong in the typical way that people say, oh, I don't belong. It, you know, my family was very messy. My dad had been arrested when I was a little girl. You know, that was very traumatic. But he became my hero, and he taught me about love in a way that both my mother and father, you know, there's a piece in the book where, you know, my mom pawned all of her jewelry to throw him a 50th birthday party, to buy him a pinky ring.
It was wrapped up in a beautiful package.
And it's funny because this is the truth. My mother was not a very good mother. My mother didn't know how to nurture. My mother was the youngest of five, I think. So she was the baby. And so she was always taken care of and she was always nurtured, right? And my dad just loved her. I mean, the moment he saw her in a two-piece bathing suit somewhere, it was like, I'm going to marry that woman. And they had a phenomenal love affair. So I learned how to love through their love. I learned how to be a woman of great forgiveness because I watched my father go through hell and my mother stayed with him and stood by him. She never belittled him. And any person who mistreated him during that time, she was like, no, they're not coming back in our lives. She loved him and he loved her. So I learned love in a way that I probably wouldn't, you know, I learned it from them. I didn't learn love from being loved by her, but I learned love by watching them. And so there in and of itself is like a kind of a wacky kind of thing, right? I wasn't nurtured. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't really taken care of as a little girl, but I grew up to be very appreciative of what they had. Hmm. And I think their love is why I love my husband the way I do. You know, there's a lot of fucked up stuff in between, but I think, so I grew up out on Long Island, you know, very kind of unstable for a while. We lived, you know, in the suburbs. I still have my friend Ellen Klein, who lived across the street. You know, I love her with everything in me. She's still, you know, she's like still that girl, you know, and she did. She lived across the street on Marion Drive. And at 15 or whatever, I dropped out of high school. And I went to go live on a commune with a boy who did not love me.
And told you as much. Like,
he was pretty, you know, he said, I don't love you that way. And I thought, well, you know, he doesn't have to love me that way. But let me get out of here. But I did. So I left home and, you know, lived on a commune and for a very short period of time because Jewish girls don't go to live in communes.
And they don't drop out of school.
They go to Fortunoffs or Orbach's or, you know, or a mall. I mean, go to a mall for a year. Hang out at Baker Shoes. Don't go to, but I never knew the value of my own life. And when my dad took me to the airport to so I can get on a plane to be with a boy that didn't want me or love me, my father said to me, "I can't make your mistakes for you."
Oh, wow.
Now, here I am. He drives me from Long Island to, I forget what the airport was. It wasn't LaGuardia. It was something else. Or it wasn't Kennedy, or maybe it was. And he, I was his little girl. He was putting me on a plane to make a gigantic mistake, you know. And him saying, "I can't make your mistakes for you," was the greatest piece of advice and lesson, because my father had an incredible belief in me, and B, he himself had, you know, a, for lack of a better word, you know, a rebirth. You know, he had another chance. He was given a second chance. And I think that's partially where I get my passion for people who, you know, deserve second and third chances. Because I watched my father, you know, go from being a very big man to being a very small man to picking himself up and making something of his life and his for his family. And he was my hero. You know, he was the guy who showed me that second and third chances are, you know, what we sit in a movie theater rooting for, right? We're in a dark movie theater and we're sitting there and we're watching, you know, people falling down and we're watching them scraping and getting by and people hissing and saying, "Fuck you," and "Get out of here." And then at the end, when they redeem themselves, right, we're in a dark theater and we're rooting for them. Oh. And we don't do that often in real life. No. But in a dark movie theater, we do. We want that guy to become a hero. We want that woman to become a shiro. We want that little girl to pick herself up and, you know, basically say, "You can't bully me anymore," you know? And so for me, that's probably one of my greatest passions, is turning mistakes into mission. And to be always that woman sitting in a dark movie theater, rooting for the underdog, rooting for the person who's lost everything, rooting for someone who's made mistakes, someone who's getting out of prison, you know, and trying to get back in life, and, you know, or somebody who deserves another chance at this thing called life. So I'm going to be in a dark movie theater rooting them on, and I'm going to be out in the sunlight rooting them on. And, you know, and that's really how I feel. You know, I didn't grow up, you know, I didn't, when people say, "Oh, I'm going to leave to find myself," I didn't find myself. I wasn't leaving to find myself. I was leaving to hide from myself.
Yeah.
You know,
and what I was so drawn to and attached to is what you talk about, the differences between nice and kind and people pleasing and not being included. And how, and so I think I can relate. I think every human on earth has been left out, not invited to the bowling party, not invited to the birthday party, and how those things, and what I found so fascinating is you grew up in a home and you had these parents that were mutually, you know, mutually obsessed with each other, a mutual admiration society. And you were sort of a spectator to that and always wanted to be included and weren't always included. And at 15, here's someone who said, well, I'll include you, kind of. And you're like, oh, shit, let's go.
Yes, we kissed in the back of a car. And all of a sudden, it was like, I'm going with this guy. I don't care who he is.
He's willing to bring me, even though he's not in love with me in that way. That's fine. I'll take a leap. It was like the ultimate birthday party that you just got invited to.
You know, I think that being included or being excluded and all of that, I think that that's something that we women, you know, feel viscerally. You know, it's like if somebody's throwing a dinner and all of a sudden you find out that you're not on the dinner list. You know, I don't care how old we are. I don't care how many times we say we don't care. It triggers so much, you know, not being included, not feeling wanted. It triggers those pieces in us where we're back being that young girl or that little girl or not getting invited to the bowling party or, oh my God, they're going to Carvel and I'm not going to get sprinkles on my ice cream cone because they're not invited. You know, all we really want as human beings, bottom line, is to be loved.
Yeah.
That's all we want. And how we seek it is how, you know, whatever we do, right? You know, some people like think, okay, I'm going to become the greatest person. You know, I'm going to become a goat and I'm going to become the greatest at something and everyone will love me. But everything we do, everything is because we want to be loved. And the hoops we go through and the crazy stuff we do and the mistakes we make and the mistakes we sleep with and the mistakes we marry and the mistakes, you know, it all comes down to wanting to be loved.
100%. And in its simplest form, to your point, it's being included, being invited, right? What does love mean, right? To so many of us. And if you think about it, public speaking, they say, is the number one fear of most humans. And if you think about it, why would that be a bigger fear than death, right? But if you play it out to its extreme, it gets to your point. If I get on stage and if I make a total ass and a debacle of myself and I have a panic attack and I can't get the words out, then people will think I'm a failure. People will think I'm a loser and everybody will abandon me. And they'll jump ship. And ultimately, it's fear of rejection.
Absolutely. That's it. Bingo. And you know, how many people fear that?
Everybody. Everybody.
And if people don't tell you that, you know, if people say, oh, that isn't, you know, my thing, or I'm not worried about being abandoned, or no, I overcame that. You know, no. Those are things that, you know, come back in different shapes and forms. And, you know, 100 years ago, you know, somebody said to me, what is your greatest fear? Right. And seriously, this was pre-Ken. And, you know, I listed like 12 things. And he said, no, it's only one. It's only one thing. And all those other things are born out of that one thing. And I remembered thinking I went in and I really kind of struggled with what is it that I'm afraid of? Why is it that I'm afraid to get close to, you know, somebody? Why is it that I choose men who, you know, I have to try to make happy? And I realized, you know, after like doing this incredible dive inward, that I was afraid of abandonment.
Yeah.
And I could pinpoint why I was afraid of it and where it was born and why every time I was in a situation where I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be left or, you know, I envisioned this little girl, you know, sitting with her valise at her grandmother's waiting for her mother to come back for her. you know, because I would, my mom would take me to Brooklyn every kind of almost every weekend, and I would hang with my grandparents who were Yiddish and didn't speak a word. You know, it was like I was Hamie. And I came home and it was like, no, my name is Hamie. It's not
H-A-M-E-Y, Hamie.
Hamie. And, you know, and I also learned love from my grandparents in a very incredible way. And, you know, I think that it takes us a long time, you know, to really kind of understand what it is. You know, it's like it all comes down to love. Everything.
And speaking of love, so from 15 to 38, let me say that your dating life was sort of like an everything bagel. There was a whole
everything
into it, some good, some bad, some really, really bad.
Yeah, you know, and really a lot of it was that, and these weren't bad men. I mean, some of them were. I mean, some of them probably, you know, had just gotten out of a penitentiary, you know, for, you know, some heinous crime. But mostly it was that, you know, I was choosing the men that matched my own life condition. I was choosing men who matched exactly how I felt about my own life.
Oh, say that again for the people in the back.
I was choosing men who matched exactly how I felt about my own life.
Oof.
And really, truly, that is the honest, raw bottom line. You know, I was choosing men that couldn't give me what I wanted. I was choosing men that hurt me. I was choosing men that treated me awful. I was choosing men that, and the thing about it, and I know you'll understand this. I look at photos of me now, back then, and I think, oh my God, I was gorgeous.
Mighty gorgeous.
Mighty gorgeous. I see a woman or a young woman who was beautiful. I mean, I see, you know, this, but I never saw that then. So now when I look at photos of me when I was younger, I think, oh my God, how beautiful, you know, and my hair and, you know, and all kinds of things. And I thought, okay, you know, when that guy told me that he loved me or thought I was beautiful, why didn't I believe him?
Yeah.
Why did I believe the ones who hurt me? Because I remember there was one guy who actually said to me, do you know how beautiful you are? And I was like, oh, this guy is fucking nuts. This guy is certifiable. This guy so desperately is crazy. But he wasn't. Because now when I see the photo of the woman he looked at, I think, wow, he wasn't lying. But, you know, I think how we view our own lives, we bring into our lives, you know, it's like if you don't feel good about who you are in the world, or if you don't think you're enough, or if you don't think you're worthy, or all of those things that we've been talking about for years now, you're going to bring people in that kind of match that so that you can go, see that I'm not worthy, see that I'm not enough. See that? I'm not, you know, and we don't believe it's, I think there's a great line from Pretty Woman where she says something like, why do we believe the bad?
Why do we believe the bad?
We were conditioned to believe, you know, the bad stuff.
So the tiger wouldn't eat us, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Fight or flight, right? And it's fake fear and fake bad, right? But you're right. Those bad seeds, I always say, we talk about this at Smart Dating Academy. It's those 3 to 5 bad seeds that, you know, I look at us as there's always seeds around our heads, right? And sometimes a lot of the seeds just repel and they fall to the ground. There are certain seeds that implant themselves in our brains and they turn into giant, mighty oak trees. And they're always the bad trees.
Yes, they are the bad chia pet trees.
That, and you got to take it. You got to take a damn axe and chop down those bad trees, because most likely the seeds that we allowed to plant in our brains of you're not pretty enough, you're fat, you're old, you're this, you're that, that person has no idea they even said that or that we interpreted what they said that way.
Exactly. It's in how we interpret it. Yes.
And we give away our power. And if you're listening to this, I want you to go, oh my God, if this is me, take your power back. Chop those trees down, ladies and gentlemen.
And we give away our power because we think, okay, that's going to get someone to love us. Or that's, if we give something away, whatever it is, right? Whether it's our power, whether it's things we own, whether it's, oh, you like my shoes, here, take them, you know, whatever. We give them away because we want someone to love us, yeah, right? And we can't do that anymore. We have to love ourselves more and love people less who you know, and power is not anger.
No.
Power is not, you know, anger. Power is not mean. Power is not, you know, fuck you. No, that is not power.
No, power is peace.
Yes.
Power is peace. Well, I'm so curious. So we go from 15 to 38, kind of doing a little of this, doing a little of that. You know, you guys have to read this book. Maybe did one night at a topless dance club, trying to earn some tips. We've done it all with the delightful Amy Ferris. And then at 38, this man comes along. Tell us about this love story.
You know what's wonderful about this story right now is that it was born out of the 1988 Writers Guild strike.
Right.
Truly. Pretty quickly. It was, you know, coincidentally. So I met this woman on the picket line, and she and I were like the only two chicks that were walking around, you know, fuck you, WG, you know, fuck you, you know, we're WGA writers, you know, and we need to get paid and all that. And we connected and we decided, well, let's write a script together, you know, because that's what we did. We were writers, you know, and so that's how the script Mr. Wonderful was born. And it, you know, you couldn't sell it when you were writing it, but we were able to kind of get a little bit of attention. And then the movie got bought, the script got bought, and Anthony Minghella, who had directed Truly, Madly, Deeply and was like the coolest guy in town, was looking for his first kind of like Hollywood movie to direct. And he got the script, Mr. Wonderful. And that was it. It was kind of like, because Anthony grew up in a very working class family in London. You know, I think if I'm not mistaken, his family owned like a, you know, like an ice cream parlor, pizza joint kind of thing. And Anthony was a brilliant, brilliant writer and a brilliant director. And so he was, you know, directing the movie, and I think it was the second or third day of shooting, and it was downtown. And I also happened to have known Matt Dillon, who was in the movie. So it was cool to hang with him.
Oh my God. Like, I think I had 27,000 posters of Matt Dillon.
Well,
my seventh grade bedroom.
Matt Dillon was and is one of the kindest people on the planet. really no, you know, and the cast was amazing. It was Bill Hurd. It was James Gandolfini. It was Annabella Sciorra. It was Mary Louise Parker. You know, it was pretty extraordinary. And anyway, so I'm standing with Matt and I'm chatting and there's this guy on a camera and he's way up on a crane and he's wearing a hat and he looks like Clint Eastwood. And at that very same moment, we looked at each other. I looked up at him. And back then I was like wearing a white t-shirt and jeans and nothing fancy. And, you know, my hair was really wild. And I left and I, you know, left. And then that night, the production manager said, "Hey, do you want to join us for drinks?" And I said, "Sure." And, you know, I came out of my apartment and Ken was, I went, "Oh my God, Clint Eastwood." And he went, "Oh my God, the vest," because I was wearing a vest. And it was like, and it was wild and wonderful and nothing happened. Nothing at all happened because Ken was actually involved with somebody. And I said, "When you can call me," this is how I knew everything was different, by the way, because I didn't go to, I didn't invite him in and sleep with him. I mean, you know, we didn't fuck in the elevator. You know, it was like I said, "When you can give me your phone number,
when you're available,
truly, and you can call and leave your phone number, that's, you know,
that's when you'll be Mr. Wonderful."
That's when, and, you know, and then what ended up happening, which is kind of like, I think I've written about it so many times. He said he was going to, it was over Labor Day weekend. And he said, "I'm going to call you," you know, and I, back then we didn't have cell phones. We had like shoe boxes, right? It was like, you know, I mean, you go out with like a shoe box and you call from a phone booth to collect your messages. And it's like, you're in a phone booth for 18 hours, you know? And he said, "I'll call you." And he didn't call me. And I showed up on the set on Tuesday and I marched onto the set. And I was like filled with like just fierce and fire. And he was on one more crane and James Gandolfini was in the shot. And I walked onto the set and I said, "Excuse me, you up there on the crane, you said you were going to call me. You didn't fucking call me. I had you pegged as someone different. Fuck you." And all of a sudden, Anthony Minghella goes, "Okay, cut. And the crane comes down and Minghella comes over to me and he said, in his wonderful British clip, "You, my darling, have a set of platinum balls." I mean, it was like I showed up on the set. I had no, you know, didn't realize, you know, I'd never really been on a set. I didn't realize you can't just barge on, you know, and while they're shooting and, you know, and all kinds of crazy.
Read somebody the riot act.
You know, and James Gandolfini thought I was the coolest girl on the planet at that moment. And Ken came off the crane, came down. It was like the parting of the Red Sea, literally, like the crew.
Everybody's like, "Oh, geez, what's going to happen?"
And Ken comes down and he was walking toward me and I'm like, "Fuck you." And he said, "I will never do that again." And I said, "Okay, you're game. You're on."
Okay.
And he has been calling me ever since.
Oh, and you guys just celebrated your 30-year wedding anniversary.
We celebrated our 30th anniversary. And, you know, I'm a handful. I'm, you know, and Ken is, you know, he's just this simple, kind, loving, generous man. You know, he doesn't have a whole lot of crazy. You know, he doesn't have a whole lot of, you know, weird shit going down. I mean, I, you know, can list mine alphabetical and it's always astonishing to me that, you know, that he loved me so unconditionally. And I think, and this is really for everybody to hear, I think when we stand up for what it is, you know, some people will say, oh, you made a fool of yourself, or why did you do that? Or why did you show up there? I knew that if I didn't say that, if I didn't show up that day, that afternoon, and say to him, you said you, because that was what every man says, right? Or not every man, but how many women will say to you, oh yeah, or how many men will say to you, or how many women will say that women, you know, it doesn't even matter our gender, you know, I'll call you. And we wait for the phone call because we don't think we're enough, because we don't think we deserve more. And we sit there. I felt like I was living out, like, you know, a Ray Milland movie. I didn't want to go to the bathroom. I had to bring my phone with me. You know, it was like so neurotic, right? Every time the phone rang, it was like, oh my God, it's Ken. And it was like, excuse me, I can't talk to you right now. I'm waiting for a phone call.
Right. I can't have it ring busy because we don't even have call waiting.
Have call waiting right now. It's like, it was such a different time. And, you know, and that was when that was about taking back my power. Because in that moment, I didn't care if he was going to call me or not call me. I cared that I stopped that, that habit, that bad habit, you know, it had to stop right there with me. You know, no man ever, I didn't care if I was alone the rest of my life. I didn't care. I really, but no man, I was not going to allow myself to have another relationship with someone who didn't deserve the privilege of my life.
It's like you had grown into yourself and you didn't even know it.
Exactly. And I was given the opportunity to do it. And it was with the exact right person.
And he came in a different package than you probably expected.
Oh my God, totally different.
Right?
You know, he drove a Subaru pickup truck and he was a cameraman and, you know, and he was into gardening and I was into Barney's and, you know, and he would say, yeah, go get tomatoes. So I would go to the store and he'd say, no, we're growing tomatoes. Right. And we're growing them. And it's like, what do you mean we're growing tomatoes? You know, it's like he was growing vegetables and flowers and I was buying vegetables and flowers and, you know, and he's a good man. He's a good, good man.
And you knew what a good man was because your father was a good man. And it's like, when I read this, I thought, you know what? She came home. You came home with Ken.
Thank you for saying that. That is so gorgeous. I did. I came home with Ken.
You came home. And you found someone who loves you the way you spectated that love as little Amy. You took a, you know, a messy, gorgeous path to get there, but you found him when you developed the resolve to say, I'm not going to give you a hall pass. I'm going to basically, you said you called, you would call and you didn't. And I'm going to call you out on that. And you held his feet to the fire.
I did.
And he was ready. And he was the right one. Right?
No, it was, yes. And, you know, he had been married before, you know, on our official second date, he said to me, I just want you to know I'm never getting married again. And I said, I just want you to know that I want a second wine. That's all. I just want to have my second glass of wine. You know, it was kind of like, I'm not getting married again. And you know, but life actually threw us together in such a way that 4 months after we met, and fell in love, he actually asked me to marry him, you know. And, you know, I can't imagine what, you know, I just can't imagine how anything could be any better than it is for me in terms of the road that I took and the journey that I took, and that I stood up for my life. And the moment I did that, I stood up for love in some form.
You stood up for love, in a sense, you began to love yourself.
Absolutely.
And that was the key. I will accept this, and I will not accept these crumbs anymore.
Exactly. No more crumbs.
I want the pie. I want the whole pie.
And I want whipped cream, and I want extra. And yes.
And you know, eat it up a little nicely too. And maybe a la mode.
A la mode.
I don't choose.
Maybe there should be a guy out there, a la mode.
A la mode. Oh my gosh. I'm starting to think this could be your next book, a la mode.
I like that. A la mode. Yes. He was on the, but yes. So that's my little love story, which is messy and complicated and gorgeous.
Mighty gorgeous. And what would you tell somebody who's listening to this right now? And maybe they're 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, and they're in their car, or maybe they're on the treadmill and they're listening to us. What would you tell them that you would want them to do for themselves?
I would want them to look themselves in the eye. I would like for them to go and look at themselves in a mirror. I don't care if it's a compact. I don't care if it's a full length. And I want them to say, you're the best there is.
Oh my God, I have like electricity in every body part right now.
I think that we all need to love ourselves the way that we want others to love us, and like us the way that we want others to like us, and give to us what we want others to give to us. I think that, you know, that's a really important thing, is if we want people to love us and like us and respect us and honor us, and we have to do that. You know, if we want them to give that to us, then we need to give that to us. We shouldn't be afraid of giving it to ourselves. I think there's this kind of false notion that if we love ourselves, then we won't have love. Or if we like ourselves, we won't have people. Or if we treat ourselves well, then, because I think a lot of the pain that we suffer through is loneliness. Thinking, oh my God, if I like me, then I don't need anybody to like me. You know, I think we got it wrong along the way, you know. And, you know, we can listen to everybody. I know I listen to all of these incredible podcasts and read all of these things about being enough. You know, I think that it's more than just feeling like being enough. I think it's knowing that who you are is pretty extraordinary.
Exactly. Exactly as you are.
Yeah, you know, we all fuck up and we all make mistakes and we all fumble and we all have so many flaws and we all wish we could take back things we said and did. And, you know, we all wish we could rewind 120 days. You know, we all wish that, you know, we were more compassionate or, you know, but that's all of that stuff makes us so incredible. It makes us understand another human being, right?
Totally. I often say, I wish, you know, if I could create something, it would be an undo button for my life. Like, could I click undo on that thing that just happened to get redo? Wow, we can do it online. And knowing that it's okay to not be perfect. And I think we hold ourselves to these crazy, like, oh my gosh, if I'm not perfect, then my world's going to fall apart and people will see that I'm not perfect and they're not going to want to be around me. And yet I find the people that I love the most in my life are the people that are willing to wear their imperfections as a sandwich board.
Absolutely.
Like, and they're announcing it to the world. They put it over their head and it's on their chest and it's on their back. And they're walking around Times Square or Michigan Avenue in Chicago saying, here's what I got. And it's okay. And those are people that you can really have a real, true connection with. And remember, all of your stuff, my dear friend, my dear listener, all of the things that you think make you unlovable, undateable, unrelationshipable, if that's even a word.
It's a good word.
Unrelationshipable. It's all BS at the end of the day. You are magical and glorious exactly as you are. And the day that you do what Amy Farrah says and look in the mirror and be like, God, I love this person. Look at all of the beautiful things I've seen. I've done this exercise with clients and it produces tears for them and me every single time. We look in a mirror together and I'll say, tell me what you see. Oh. And they'll tell me five things. If I even talk about it, it brings me to tears. They will tell, I look at the thighs, look at the burnt skin on my face, look at my eyes that are crooked. And I'm like, that's what you see?
Isn't that amazing?
Amazing. And if you look in the mirror, maybe look in the mirror, you guys. Find someone who loves you, an elevator person, and do this exercise with them. It will bring you to your knees and transform you in the most sparkly way. What you think others see is not what they see.
And isn't that remarkable? It's kind of like, you know, when we see a piece of art, right? Let's for an example, you know, a stained glass, a piece of stained glass. And we look at it and we stare at it and we think, oh my God, how gorgeous, how the light comes in. And oh, and you know, that's exactly who we are. We're pieces of, you know, edgy and misshapen and you know, dark and bright and, you know, we are an extraordinarily gorgeous mosaic, and we're fill everything that we do. I think the whole thing about perfection, you know, is so out of whack. And it's, you know, what is perfect? And if we think about, you know, when we read about somebody taking their life, right? And we go, oh my God, wasn't he happy? Didn't he have a perfect life? Didn't she, you know? And no, they didn't.
They didn't.
And society is such that we have to, everything needs to be perfect, right? And neat, you know, and like in boxes and filed, and you know, it's like you can't have an overstuffed refrigerator, you know, you're not allowed to have junk drawers, you know, but that's what life is.
Life is a giant junk drawer.
It is, you know, and I think that once we really, really, really get that, you know, once people can say, wow, my life is a junk drawer. You know, I got all this shit in there. You know, what is it that you want to keep that makes you happy? What is it that, you know, I'm not into the whole, you know, touch that Marie, whatever her name is.
Marie Kondo.
You know.
To bring you joy, if not pitch it.
You know, I'm the chick who still has stuff in her closet from 1992. I couldn't fit in it if someone literally like said, I'm going to... I'm gonna, you know, like rip you to shreds if you can't. But I have stuff in my closet. Ken once said to me, "Amy, this is true." He said, "Is this a belt?" And I said, "No, Ken, it's a black mini dress." a black miniskirt. He said, oh, because it was like this big. And it was like when I was, you know, 102 pounds and I keep things, you know, it's like, and he was like, is that a belt? I laughed and I said, no, Ken, it was a skirt.
It used to cover my bum.
And you know, it's like, I keep it in my closet because I think, wow, what was I thinking back then? You know, and who was I back then? And, you know, and all that stuff. And I just think we need to love ourselves and accept, you know, all the shit that we do, because it gets us to where we want to go.
100%.
Absolutely. I mean, and Jill, you know how much we love Jill. She's
Jill Sharer Murphy. I hope you're listening.
She's like the queen of this, you know, we're afraid to love our own lives.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We need to.
Yeah. And like Jill says, you've got to let go of all the shit. You've got to let go for what you really want. And
exactly.
Let go of the things you think that I think. Look at yourself in the mirror. And you know what? Here's what we all do. Let's go back to this mirror metaphor, guys. Look at ourselves through some damn carnival mirror that makes you look short, fat, and squatty, right?
And distorted.
And distorted. And that's the mirror with which we look at ourselves.
Exactly. That's perfect.
And I want you to metaphorically get a straight mirror and look at yourself and do this with someone that loves you and do the compare contrast. It's going to knock you out of your chair. If you don't cry, write me a note. And I'll take you out to the bike racks and we'll duke it out.
Schwinn
all the way. Amy, is there anything I didn't ask you that you want our listeners to know, to take with them?
You know, I think the only thing I would love for them to take away from all of this is that every single thing that we do, the shameful things, the dirty things, the weird things, the joyous things, the glorious things, every single thing is what makes us extraordinary. We're, you know, every single thing. I mean, in my book, in the very, 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 very beginning, you know, I write this, you know, which is so cliched at this point, but I write a letter to my younger self. And, you know, and Brooke, my publisher, said to me, what would you tell your younger self, Amy? Really, what would you tell her? And I would tell her to do exactly what she's going to do, because when she says, when I grow up, I want to be, she grew up to be exactly who she wanted to be. And I think that that's something we all need to feel better about. And look at, you know, when we say that, when we're little kids and we say, when I grow up, I want to be like her. Well, I became exactly who that little girl wanted to be.
Yeah. Plus them.
And I think that that's something that I would want people to look at in their lives. We become exactly who we want to be when we're those little kids. If we, in fact, don't for one moment think we should have changed anything.
Mm. So think about who you want to be, you guys. And sometimes we don't know that. And exactly. We haven't thought about that. So it's never too late. And all this crap that's happened to you, and if you're sitting there with those big negative oak trees in your mind, I want you to get rid of those and know, you know, we say, and I took this, I think, from Tony Robbins. I can't even remember. I've read it in so many places. What you want to do, you can look at two things. You can say, God, what a mess. Right?
Exactly.
But those who are able to find the meaning in the mess, we're all a mess. I can tell you, I can delineate 37 messes that I've created in the last 37 months, right? But if you find the meaning in the mess, that's where those lily pads come in. Like, ah, okay, this is what I got from this. And it brought me here. And that's your story. And own it. Own it. Because if you didn't have the messes, all you've got to do is go back and find the meaning. Isn't that fun? Think about the messes and find the meaning in it and own it.
Absolutely. You know, and it's so extraordinary that you and I are talking today, the day after Tina Turner died.
Yeah.
Because her life was that example. I mean, when you read about who she was, when she, you know, with 16 years of abuse with Ike, right? And, you know, and left and with 37 cents or 36 cents and went, you know, and was on food stamps for a while and crazy stuff, right? She took every bit of poison. Every bit of poison and turned it into medicine.
Mm.
She took every single thing that happened to her and transformed her life. And I think she is an extraordinary example of a woman or anybody who can say, you know what? I'm going to own my power now.
Yeah. And did that 30, after 60 years old.
It's extraordinary. And when she, you know, and I read this today or yesterday when she was in court, you know, for her divorce proceedings, and she didn't want anything. She didn't want the house. She didn't want, you know, she didn't want the rights to her music. She said, all I want is a future.
Mm.
That's all she wanted. I mean, it was kind of like, wow, she only wanted her future. Doesn't that, you know, it's like you think about it and you think, here's this woman who we loved, right? And we loved Tina Turner, not just because she was a fierce, fiery, gorgeous queen. We loved her because she overcame so much stuff. That when she stood on that stage and sang and shimmied and used her body and used her power, because we had already known that she was, you know, abused and used and hurt and, you know, and tried to kill herself and all this stuff. So brings us right back to, you know, we root for those people.
We did
a dark movie theater. And we have to start rooting for those people in life, because people like Tina Turner, really, truly, I mean, she pulled herself up and out. And maybe somebody would think, oh, I can't share that kind of story. That's too dirty. That's too messy. That's too, you know, oof, it's down and dirty, ugly. But she shared it. And it's why we loved her.
Exactly, guys. Share your mess with others, because yes, we're all a mess. And if you share your mess with me, it's going to make me share my mess with you. And that's how we connect. And just like Amy said at the beginning, we are love and we are our relationships.
Oof.
That's what we are. And elevate the people around you. Be that person, not just in a movie theater watching somebody else's life. Elevate the people around you. But most importantly, look in the mirror and elevate yourself. And think about what you will and won't accept from now on. And I want you to remember, as always, you guys, love will come to you in the way you want it. And remember, it's a when, it's not an if.
Exactly. It's a when.
It's a when. Okay. Amy came from, you know, non-traditional, you know, everything. And look at her story, right? And she owned it. And she took responsibility for her own life and grew into herself and said, this is what I will take and this is what I won't take, and has the best lid to her pot. And her love just like you've heard me talk about 1,000 times, came in an unexpected package. So I want you to be inspired that he might drive up in a Subaru truck. He might be on a crane filming you, or he might be on a train. He might be sitting next to you on a plane. He might be, you know, the gym teacher at your kid's school. She might be the bus driver. I don't know, but be open to love and know what you will and you will not tolerate this time around. Because remember, good love, it's always work, but it's never soul crushing work. Overall, it's easy.
I love that. I love that. And you know, I just want to add one thing. Let's not be afraid to let people in and love us. I think that that's also, because when you talk about packages, you know, we have an idea of who that person is, what that person's going to look like, or what we want, right? And a lot of those people that we think, oh, I want that. That's, you know, that's the package. Yeah, that package may not be kind. That package may not be good. That package may not have a real long shelf life. You know, I think we just, listening to you made me just go, wow, you know, we want love, but then we kind of push it away or keep it a distance, or, you know, think, oh no, that's not, you know, I think we also have to really talk about what it is that love looks like. You know, are you really looking for love, or are you looking for something else? Right. You know, maybe it's that we don't really know how to describe what love is. You know, that's something, you know, that you're making me think about right now is, you know, what do we think love is?
Oh, that is like, that is going to be our podcast. I got you.
You know, that's like, what do we think love is?
Yeah. Love. Oh, I will tell you what, love is a verb. It's not a noun. It's an action. It's not a feeling. Yes.
Exactly.
And you know that, and I know that, and I think anybody who's really honest with themselves, don't mistake chemistry for love. Lust is nature's way of tricking us into attachment. Okay.
That's very true. That is perfect. That is so true.
Right. And that's where you get into messy love, you all. Let's just call that messy lust at the end of the day. Right. Had that. So, Amy,
really true.
You are remarkable as a human being. And I'm going to say you are now my friend, just like Jill is my friend. And
I'm so happy. This makes me so happy.
You're a blazing talent, and I can't wait. How can we get a copy of your book? I know this is early and we're in like pre-order stage. We can pre-order it.
Yes, you can go on to Amazon, pre-order it.
I'm going to put a link in the show notes, y'all. So don't worry. Please order this book. I'm telling you, I still need to get out on a 26,000 mile run to process all of this. And this is one you're going to want to read again, again, and again, because it's the opposite of messy. It's beautiful. So thank you so much for being a guest, and promise me you'll come back to our show.
I will absolutely come back.
Yay! So happy.
And maybe we can bring Jill and Melissa Gilbertson. Maybe we can do like a whole thing about what is love.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. That's a resounding violent yes.
I think that would be extraordinary. What is love?
What is love? Well, oh.
Well, I can tell you, you are love. And this has been, I'm going to say this, hearing you read my life is one of the highlights of my life. And I mean that. You really cracked me open. So thank you, you gorgeous woman.
Right back at you. You cracked me open with your book. So love right back at you. So I'm honored to have had this conversation and I cannot wait for our next one. So smart daters, order that book and remember, listen to our fill out our podcast listener survey because we want to continue to serve you. That's the goal of this podcast. We want to help you to become happier, messier, cleaner, bring more love into your life. All of it. So fill out that podcast so we can bring you more of what you want to hear. With that being said, follow us on Instagram. We've got lots of stuff to inspire you on a daily basis. We love you. And as always, see you next week. Thanks for listening. And as always, download us, share us, show us the love. Follow Instagram at Smart Dating Academy. And if you or someone you know wants to learn more, check out our website at smartdatingacademy.com. We're here to bring you love.